apparently a lot quicker as far as the devastation. So come to pass in that day that there will be a great tumult from the Eternal shall be among them. They shall lay hold every one on the hand of his neighbor, and his hand shall rise up against the hand of his neighbor. And Judah shall also fight at Jerusalem. Or as a margin, I think reads, this says against Jerusalem, and other commentaries will say in Jerusalem. In other words, Judah fights from two aspects. One, we've already read that there are some in Judah that see what's happening around outside them, so they would fight from within the city walls. There are others of the Jews that are taken captive in other lands that God brings back, releases them, and there's a battle that takes place. Regardless, he is talking about Judah actually fighting to reclaim Jerusalem. We can tie in chapter 10 and verse 5. They shall be as a mighty man that tread down the enemies in the mires of the streets. They shall fight because the Eternal is with them, and the riders on horses shall be confounded. That, first of all, the Maccabees felt that this was their time to fight, and based upon these prophecies, as far as fighting for the land and establishing the land, they felt that was their responsibility. Surely in the future, chapter 11, verse 6, and 14, 12 through 14, we see that Judah will fight again. And again, the underlying principle that we would establish church-wise is John chapter 18, verse 36. When this world becomes God's kingdom, when God comes back to actually reign through Jesus Christ comes back to reign, at that particular time, his kingdom is of this world, then his servants will fight. Most of his servants will be spirit at that point and able to fight a lot better, I guess. Verse 14, they shall fight in Jerusalem. The wealth of all the heathen round about shall be gathered together, gold, silver, apparel, and in great abundance. So shall the plague of the horse and the mule, the camel, the ass, all the beasts shall be in the tents as this plague. A lot of times it refers to the animals because these were the beasts of the military. We're going to read in a later verse, he talks about the horses. Well, he's talking about the military and the changes that are going to take place. All the horses, the mules, camels, aren't going to do them any good. Verse 16 through 21, we see the glory of Christ abiding in Jerusalem. Glory of Christ abiding in Jerusalem. Verse 16, it shall come to pass, everyone that is left of all the nations which come up against Jerusalem shall even go up year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. So they go to worship the King. It's interesting that in Malachi 1, verse 14, we'll get to a little bit later, he talks about, I am a great king, says the Eternal of Hosts, and my name is dreadful among the heathen. So we see the king that is established, a great king, and they're going to go up year by year to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. We do see evidence of the holy days being kept in the millennium, apparently to remind people of what went before. And, of course, the holy days now remind us and tell us of the plan of God. What's coming? Well, what went before? Passover. Pentecost, which is still ongoing, that of the first fruits. We look ahead then in the plan of God to the trumpets, atonement, tabernacles, and then the last great day. At that particular point, most of them will be looking back. One will be looking at the present, and of course there'll be one still looking towards the future, that of the last great day of that resurrection. So it's still going to be very important that these holy days are kept throughout the millennium. So, and it shall be, whoso will not go up with the families of the earth into Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, even unto them there shall be no rain. So we would see that there is a gradual conversion in the millennium. Christ returns, sets up his kingdom, there is the atonement, which is the binding of Satan. Satan cast into the bottomless pit, as we read in Revelation. And then the millennium starts. But it's going to take some time. They're going to establish the kingdom and establish the holy days that they're to come up to worship. Some will and some won't. Some will still decide that there's other ways that it can be done. And they won't get rain. And at verse 18, if the family of Egypt do not go up, come not, there will be no rain. There shall be the plague, wherewith the Eternal will smite the heathen that come not up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. The Nile River flows through Egypt and is not quite so dependent on rain. Now, you know, if they don't have rain, it's going to go down some and hurts them a little bit. But because of the amount of water through the Nile, that doesn't decimate them as much as the plague. So God adds a plague. For others, say in Israel, it might be enough not to send rain. Because if they don't send rain, if God doesn't send rain, they're not going to have crops, period. Israel is very dependent on rain. The Nile, not quite so much. But we see a plague that is issued with that. This shall be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all nations that come not up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles in verse 19. We see then in verse 20, there was something I was going to say. The fact of this aspect of the gradual conversion of the millennium. I mean, the reason that he says this is because apparently it's somewhat prophetic that God believes God is not going to force everyone immediately to obey him. Yes, every knee shall bow, but it's not a he comes, he says, okay, everybody, and then just kind of wipes clear all the bad thoughts and forces them to convert. God does not force anyone to convert. He will make sure they know who God is. They will know then that there's only one way to salvation. In opposition to many of the thoughts and beliefs now. Verse 20 then, we see that in that day there shall be upon the bells of the horses, and the bells is better translated, the bridles of the horses, this name, holiness, or this sign, holiness unto the eternal. Holiness unto the eternal. This is the same that was on the mitre on the head of the high priest. Remember, the mitre is the priestly hat that they wore. It's the same thing that was written there, Exodus 28, verse 38. Exodus 28:38. It was on the mitre of the head of the high priest. So the first half of the verse, bells upon the horses or bridles, is a sign showing that the instruments of war now are for peace. The instruments of war, and of course the horses as an instrument of war, are now turned and now they are committed to holiness unto God. Not that the horses are holy, but mankind is changing. They're no longer making implements of war. Micah 4 verses 3 and 4. It's easy in this class to know when you're ready for me to go on because the little click, 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 click stops. And then they're with me. It's harder in some of the other classes because they don't write as loud as some of you do. The pots in the Lord's house shall be like the bowls before the altar. In other words, everything is going to be used for a godly purpose, not for miscreants, for evil, for doing things that are wrong. It really ends this concept of secular and sacred. Secular and sacred. Which, of course, has been the big issue in the West, in democracy, is to carefully separate the sacred from the civil. We find more and more a push in other lands, in Eastern lands. It's very much, the religion is very much tied into their culture, towards their government, the whole works. So I personally think we're going to see a lot more of that even in the West as things make adjustment. It is the push in Christianity to more of the concept of pluralism and use of religion even within government. It may be some time, but every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah shall be holiness unto the eternal hosts, and all they that sacrifice shall come and take of them and seethe therein. Seethe is to boil. And in that day there will be no more the Canaanite in the house of the eternal of hosts. Canaanite means one who profanes. One who profanes. So we see sacrifices in the millennium. We have the holy days, we have sacrifices, much different, I believe, than what we see in Leviticus 1 through 5 and the great, tremendous sacrificial system, but one to remind the people then of what went on before. The sacrifices were to point to Christ. Christ at that time will be enthroned in Mount Zion and a teaching from Mount Zion, but we see that there are sacrifices. And we would For the most part, the way I've heard it explained is that we would still view those as, you know, being literal, that there would be a temple that would be established, and that there would be sacrifices. Again, not to the extent of the Levitical priesthood in that, but periodic. Some might say, well, you know, maybe it's figurative, and I, you know, really don't have a comment on that. Maybe it is. Okay, that's Zechariah. Any quick questions? We need to get right on with Malachi. Rob. On verse 20, this sign, this name, holiness unto the eternal, is also the name or the sign that was on the mitre of this cap worn by the high priest. So what he's just simply saying is that the horses, which are, you know, very civil-oriented, nothing real sacred about horses, I don't think, that that then combines with the, everything is holy unto God. Everything has a purpose of serving God. Not that horses are holy. You know, that's maybe awkward to explain. But that there's no longer the commitment to selfishness and to greed and to setting up of military and those armies, so therefore this is signifying that. Again, it's figurative. I don't think literally that all the horses are running around with, you know, this sign. You know, again, maybe it could be. That I think are particularly important in the book of Zechariah for the ongoing life after you get out of college that you need to have memorized. That's the purpose of the question? Or something, oh, something more immediate. Yes, well, chapter 4, verse 6 is a very good one. Chapter 3, verse 1, I think from the aspect of just knowing that this is Satan standing up against the work, fighting against the work, fighting against what Christ is doing and what that pictures, to know the that, because that's been a very much preached chapter over the last 10 or 15 years. Over the last 6 or 7 years, it's been preached much more accurately than before that because of the misunderstandings that we had. 4 verse 6, and I particularly like 7 verse 9. And therefore, if I particularly like it, there is a chance that you better like it too. Execute true judgment, show mercy and compassion every man on his brother. And then chapter 14, I think, is the only other one per se. I would know that 14:16 refers to the Feast of Tabernacles being kept in the millennium, and 14:21 referring to sacrifices kept in the millennium. Okay? Any other questions? All right. Book of Malachi. Do you have the handout on that already then? On Malachi? Good. If we go back to our chart that we've been working from, we've concluded now Zechariah 14. I think this is on the third page, which we need to add numbers to this. It's on the fourth page. One, two, three, fourth page. We come after the time of Zechariah to Xerxes in 486 to 465. This is a Xerxes of that's also known as Ahasuerus. Okay, this is the other original that we're working off of with Haggai, Zechariah. You all have that? Is there anyone that does not have this one? You've been gone too long. You don't know what's going on in this class. Okay, well, you might, if you don't have one, you can get another copy from Russ. But looking at that outline, which we're at that point putting all of the post-exilic books into one outline and tying those in with Ezra and Nehemiah, Ezra 4 verse 6 talks about it was during that time period of Ahasuerus that the work in Jerusalem was stopped. It is the time of Esther and the dealings there with the Jews. And we can see that there was a lot of animosity against the Jews, at least by Haman, and within the kingdom that finally then Esther rises to the occasion to save the Jewish people. We then go to Artaxerxes the First in 465 to 424. Work in the city and on the walls was stopped about 460, as we can read in Ezra chapter 4, verses 7 through 23. 457 is Artaxerxes' decree to Ezra to rebuild the city. We find that in Ezra 7. So Ezra came to Jerusalem with the second group of returnees, a smaller group than the first group, as they do come back to reestablish the land. And this is the decree that was promised by Daniel in Daniel chapter 9. You might know the differences of the decrees between this one and Cyrus. Sometimes people get confused with those because they're two different decrees. One is the first one from the Medo-Persian Empire for them to go back and to settle the land to build the temple. They started to build, and they were stopped. Then they started again in 520 and finished about 516 to 515 and concluded that. Then we have a period of time that everybody just kind of continues in what they're doing and get a little bit further and further away from God to the time of 457 when then Ezra is sent back to finish building on the city, to rebuild the city. It is some 12 years later, 445 to 444, that Nehemiah comes to Jerusalem. And we then have the book of Nehemiah that is set at that time. He goes there to restore the political and economic strength, to rebuild the wall. And you should know, for history's sake, you should know some of these major episodes. Know when Ezra came and when Nehemiah came. Know their specific or their general responsibilities to rebuild the city for Ezra, as well as to reestablish worship. Nehemiah to restore political, economic strength, to rebuild the wall, which he did, and you can read through Nehemiah. I'm not asking you to read through Nehemiah. I'm not going to get any more specific than that on any question on the test. That would be something maybe do an Old Testament survey, but I think it's very interesting as you correlate then getting to the book of Malachi to see what was going on in the land, the difficulties they were experiencing. 443 we've got on the last page of the handout. Nehemiah returned to Persia in Nehemiah chapter 13. The priests in Jerusalem became lax. Eliashib, the high priest, was to blame. And we pick up then the time period of Malachi's prophecies. And I think this may be the same outline as we just gave you. In fact, it may be a little bit more detailed on this chart that we already gave you. But at least you got it in two different places. So we pick up Malachi's message, which is speculated anywhere from 445 or 450, I've heard that date, down to 430. I think I've seen it written some places 400. So anywhere from 450 to 400. I would place it 450 to 430, really at the time of Nehemiah, because the problems are the same problems that Malachi is addressing. And it's the problems of the priests being lax in their preaching. There are the overall theme is the day of the Lord. And the warning message for that, Malachi means my messenger. Messenger. So we have three sub-themes to the book of Malachi. It is a day of the Lord. First of all, the sins of Israel. Especially chapter 1:13, 2:14, and chapter 3, verse 5, the sins of Israel. There's 1:13, 2:14, and 3, verse 5. Secondly, the sins of the Levitical priesthood. So he gets a little bit more specific with the sins there. Chapter 1, verses 6, 10, and 14, and really the bulk of chapter 2. The third sub-theme is that of the coming judgment, chapter 2, verses 17 through chapter 4. So if we look at the specific setting that would be taking place about 450 to 430, it would be during the reign of Artaxerxes I, a time of Persian rule administered from Samaria. So the Samaritans had an upper hand, had a little bit of strength here at that point because the rule was coming from their land. At the time, the Jews were rebuilding the wall, in the process of trying to rebuild the wall and eventually the city. The Samaritans accused the Jews of treason, and so they stopped the building. As we mentioned earlier, that's Ezra chapter 4. Then finally, the decree to rebuild was given in 457. And it was then, and this is a bit repetitive of the before, but I want to go through it from the aspect of specifically what's happening here. Nehemiah then is sent back to Jerusalem. So we've got Ezra comes back in 457. Nehemiah comes in 445, and he fights against the Samaritans. Sanballat was one of the leaders. Sanballat, S-A-N-B-A-L-L-A-T, and you can pick that up in the book of Nehemiah. Was a leader of the Samaritans. So a battle takes place. It's not an easy transition, in other words. When we're reading the book of Malachi, we have to do it with the background of the difficulties between the Samaritans and the Jews, between the with the responsibilities that they had to continue the worship. And we'll see that in the book. And it's the time period, basically, of the canonization of the Old Testament. Ezra, one of Ezra's major jobs was to canonize the Old Testament. He then set up the Great Assembly, the 70 that were to then continue with the canonization and the putting together of the Bible. So we really see Malachi as the climactic book to the Old Testament as it puts together the message from the Old Testament as we go into the intertestamental periods. John? Right. At the point, the Persian rule over Palestine was centered in Samaria. In other words, that was the civil name that they give to their, some are called satraps and other names that they use for the civil leadership. But the local administration of the government from Persia took place in Samaria. So therefore, Samaria had a little bit more prestige for the whole land than did Jerusalem. It would be more of a center of people. Okay, chapter 1 and verse 1. The burden of the word of the Eternal to Israel by Malachi, or by the messenger. It is a messenger to warn people of the judgment that's to come, and of course, to prepare the way for the kingdom of God. We see God's love for Israel, and he talks about his election of Israel in verses 2 through 5. I have loved you, says the Eternal, yet you say, wherein have you loved us? You know, we've been in captivity. We've had all these problems. Was not Esau Jacob's brother, says the Eternal, yet I loved Jacob, took care of Jacob. And I hated Esau, and laid his mountains and his heritage waste for the dragons of the wilderness. Hated is even used by Christ when he says in the New Testament that unless you hate your father and your mother and your brother and your sister, your wife and yes, your own life, and love Christ, then you can't be his disciple. Well, again, it's a term that's used that's very strong, and it is the word hate in the New Testament when he says that. But it is a comparison. It is the literature of the day to go to hyperbole. Hyperbole is an extreme that you state that you know the whole audience knows that you're not saying to go out and to actually hate your parents. He's talking in the New Testament about the fact that you naturally, in most situations, naturally love parents. You naturally love yourself, take care of yourself. So that love, in comparison with the love you have for Jesus Christ, had better be as the difference between love and hate. That there's that kind of an ideal that we have to be striving for Christ. And he's saying here that he did love Jacob more than he loved Esau because of Esau's actions. Esau, at about this time, about 587, back when Judah was taken, remember that Edom was very instrumental. It was a part of Nebuchadnezzar's army when Judah was taken captive. And then they started making incursions in the southern part of Judah and moved a little bit further west. It was after that that the Nabataeans came and ran Edom out of Petra and out of that part of the world. Then they just naturally gravitated to the southern part of Judah. So by the time you come to Herod, Herod refers to himself and to others, he was Idumean. Idumean is Edom. And it by this time had moved from the area of Petra and to the east of the Jordan River, east of the Dead Sea, I guess, that far south, and had moved over then into the south of Judah. So he's saying that I laid his mountains and his heritage waste for the dragons of the wilderness, that because of his damage that he did to Jacob. And Obadiah, we went through that in great detail. I tied that into the message here. Wherefore, Edom says, we are impoverished, but we will return and build the desolate places. Thus says the Eternal of Hosts, they shall build, but I will throw down. God was going to punish Edom. They weren't going to go back and reestablish Petra, which at one time was their headquarters. At one point, Petra housed 100,000 Romans within the walls back when it was a center of trade. God says, no, they're not going to rebuild it. They're not going to be there. I will throw them down. They shall call them the border of wickedness and the people against whom the Eternal has indignation forever because of their sins against Jacob. So it's encouragement to Jacob that God is on their side. Maybe not real encouraging to Edom, but perhaps a warning to them that at least those few that would repent had better do so quickly. Your eyes shall see, and you shall say, the Eternal will be magnified from the border of Israel. So we see a promise of restoration to Israel. Verse 6 through chapter 2, verse 9, talks about the priests and the Levites and the lack of proper worship of God. A son honors his father and a servant his master, verse 6. In Israel, the fifth commandment was taken very seriously. A son or a daughter who blasphemed and who cursed his parents could be put to death. I doubt that there were too many occasions of that because parents are also to be merciful and loving. But for those, we read more and more accounts of teenagers that have gone crazy and with drugs and alcohol and that have killed others. In those situations, it would be the family responsibility in the Old Testament to see to it that they were put to death. The purpose being that there be a civilization that people could live in, that there not be the constant threat of being killed every time you left your house to go walk on the streets. And that if that were to take place, if the capital punishment took place, then it would be a warning to others and it wouldn't happen as often. So we see the stress. A son honors his father and a servant his master. That's, what was to be done in Israel and basically was being done. If then I be a father, where is my honor? If God is our Father, in that sense, where is my honor? It says that we must honor his authority, which is done through obedience. Chapter 4, verse 4. And if I be a master, where is my fear? Where is my reverence? Where is the respect from the people that is due God, the one who was Jesus Christ? The Lord of hosts says unto you, O priests that despise my name. So we see here specifically he's addressing the sins of the priests. The methodology, I think, is important to note. 8 times he poses a question and he gives an answer. 8 times in the book, chapter 1, verse 2, 1, verse 6, and verse 7 is the third one. Chapter 2, verses 14 and 17, or 4 and 5. That's chapter 2, verses 14 and 17. And chapter 3, verses 7, 8, and 13. The reason he uses this approach is probably because to make the point of man's excuses and self-justification. You pose a question, we quickly justify what we're doing. Will a man rob God? No, we're not robbing God, is the justification that man says. He says, but yes, you are robbing God. When we get over to chapter 3, says, will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me, but you say, wherein have we robbed you? In tithes and offerings. So it's this back and forth and really trying to bring out the fact of excuses that are made. So we see the denunciation of the priests is predominantly because of their neglect for the jobs, the duties that they are to perform. And we'll get back to that idea a little bit later, but I think we'll just read through here and make a few comments on it and then come back and talk about the cycle of sin that was taking place. We have the sins of the priests then. Where is my fear, says the Eternal of Hosts, O you priests that despise my name? And you say, wherein have we despised your name? Again, the self-justification, the excuse. You know, what do you mean we've done that? He answers, you offer polluted food, polluted bread upon my altar. And you say, wherein have we polluted you? In that you say, the table of the Eternal is contemptible. I would put the word say in quotes, because he's saying that by their actions, the actions of improper worship and perfunctory sacrifice, in other words, you just do it by ritual and not thinking about what it's supposed to mean, and their sacrifices were supposed to be rather expensive. You know, if you take a bull, which is worth a lot of money, and you sacrifice it, it ought to remind you, you ought not sin. Because sin is costly. It can be devastating to wealth, to blessings, and, you know, on and on the lessons were supposed to be for them to learn. But he says, you know, you don't pay any attention, even when you do sacrifice. Is it not for evil? If you offer the blind for sacrifice, is it not evil? And if you offer the lame and sick, is that not evil? So they were taking the culls of the herds, and they were sacrificing them, figuring, well, you know, we surely wouldn't want to sacrifice the best of the herd because we'll use those for breeding stock. And we'll take these culls, which really aren't that much value, as much value to me now as these others, and they were sacrificing them. Offer it now unto your governor. Will he be pleased with you or accept your person? You know, would you take that same stunted calf or whatever is wrong with the calf, would you take that to the governor, the civil leader, and present that to him? No, they wouldn't, because they'd be either laughed at or thrown in jail for not having the proper respect. God says, you're not respecting me because you don't give of the best to God. So these sacrifices he's talking about here wouldn't even be pleasing to carnal government, let alone to spiritual government. Verse 9, and now I pray you, beseech God that he will be gracious unto us. Repent, in other words. Thus has been your means. Will he regard your person, says the Eternal of Hosts? Who is there even among you that would shut the doors for nothing? Neither do you kindle fire in my altar for nothing. I have no pleasure in you, says the Eternal. Neither will I accept the offering at your hand. The point that he's making here, it would be better to not sacrifice. Better to not sacrifice than to sacrifice with disdain, with hatred towards God, with absolute lack of respect towards God. Something we have to think about as we sacrifice is, you know, our prayers are a type of sacrifice. Our commitment to serve in the church, to help other people. If we're going to go in and we got a bad attitude about serving on some committee and helping with things, and we're going to do it just because we have to do it and we're going to cause up trouble and stir up problems, he's saying, hey, look, you know, just leave it alone. Stay out of it. You're causing more problems than you're doing good. Now, his underlying point is, repent, get the right attitude, then you can serve properly, and then things will be great. But don't just go through the motions. Don't just be there just to be there so that everybody else can see you sacrificing. Hosea 6, verse 6. Hosea 6, 6. Remember we talked at that point that God, rather than sacrifice, he wanted mercy. So that the people would be merciful and they would be helping one another, then he would accept their sacrifices. Because sacrifices can be pleasing to God. They were pleasing the Old Testament in the ritualism. But he said they weren't because the people weren't obeying him. They weren't following him, so he said, look, you're just using this as an excuse to cover up. Verse 11, for from the rising of the sun even to the going down of the same, my name shall be great among the Gentiles, and in every place incense offered unto my name, and a pure offering. For my name is great among the heathen, says the Eternal of Hosts. He said the Gentiles' motives in their worship was greater and was better in their attitude towards God than the Jews. Quite an indictment against the people at this point. The same, my name shall be great among the Gentiles. And maybe he's also talking about the fact that then in the New Testament, that they would reject him, that they would not follow him, and as a result of that, it would then go on to the Gentiles, and things would become great in that capacity. My name shall be great among the Gentiles. That's probably a preferred understanding of the verse. The fact that his name, because they would not accept it, because they would not commit, then there would be others that would do greater works than the Jews because they would be committed to God. Verse 12, but you have profaned it in that you say the table of the Eternal is polluted, and the fruit thereof, even his meat, is contemptible. Through their attitudes and their actions, again going back to verse 7 and verse 8, through their actions they made the sacrifice contemptible. Verse 13, you have said, behold what a weariness it is. Oh, how tired we are, God, of doing all this stuff. Apostle Paul said, become not weary in well-doing. Was it the Apostle Paul? Where does it say that? 6:10? Okay. I couldn't figure out where it was. But I knew it said somewhere in the New Testament. But not to be weary in well-doing. And we can get so caught up in what you're doing that after a while, and you serve for years and years in whatever capacity, the priests got bored with serving God. Bored with doing the same tedium day in and day out because they weren't focused on what it was supposed to do and that it was to get them closer to God and that it was worship towards God. And you have snuffed at it. So they snuffed at, I don't know what that means. I guess that's what that means. Sniffed at it or whatever. They didn't take it seriously, I suppose, what it means. And you brought that was torn and lame and sick. Thus you've brought an offering. Should I accept this of your hand? The stingy, the deceitful attitudes where they bring the poor of the flock. But cursed be the deceiver, which has in his flock a male and vows, and sacrifices unto the Eternal a corrupt thing, for I am a great king, says the Eternal of Hosts, and my name is dreadful among the heathen. So Christ is a great king. He demanded proper sacrifice. Okay, chapter 2. Then is a warning to the priests. And now, O you priests, this commandment is for you. Very emphatic statement. Listen to this. This commandment concerns you. If you will not hear, if you will not lay it to heart to give glory unto my name. And he has three aspects here I think important to note that we must hear. We must listen. Now, we're told in the New Testament that we are to be a nation of priests, that we are called to be a nation of priests. 1 Peter 2, verse 9, that we're holy unto God. As priests, we need to take quite seriously the statements that are here. We're going to talk about it historically. And in their setting, this is what they were doing wrong. We've got to look at it today. What are we doing? Are we properly worshiping God? So we're here to listen. If you will not lay it to heart, we're to put it in our hearts to obey it. And we then in turn do something with it. We give glory unto my name, says the Eternal of Hosts. I will even send a curse among you, and I will curse your blessings. Yea, I have cursed them already because you do not lay it to heart. There was a blessing that the priest gave when he came out of the holy place, not the Holy of Holies, but the holy place when he would go in and they would trim the lamps every morning. He would come out and he would give the blessing of Numbers chapter 6, saying that, you know, they were blessed by God. He says, look, I'm going to turn that blessing into a curse because you're not willing to obey. And there were always people that would gather in the morning to hear the words of the priest as he would come out to know that God was with Israel and God was blessing them. So he says, look, quit playing the game. And just because you hear the words, there's going to be a curse underlying it from this point forward because you're not willing to obey. Yea, I've cursed them already because they do not lay it to heart. Behold, I will corrupt your seed and spread dung upon your faces, even the dung of your solemn feasts. And one shall take you away with it. With it is with the dung. Remember when they had these animals, the animals would be live. They had a killing place. They would kill them, and then they would take out the intestines and the bowels and then clean the animal and prepare it for the sacrifice. He is talking to the dung that is within the animal at the point that it is sacrificed. Any of you that have done any sacrificing, I've done once or twice, not on an altar, but I had calves when I was out in the country, and we killed one. Went up there and shot it and then hoisted it up, and you know, you go in and open it up and get the intestines out. Well, if you're careful, you can get them out in one piece. The guy who did the cutting on this one was not careful, and the odor is terrible. And what he's saying is here, the dung from all of that refuse is then going to be spread out, and that they would be carried with it, taken captive, openly disgraced, in other words, as the contents of the bowels of the slain animals were then to be strung out. Rather graphic. You shall know that I have sent this commandment unto you, that my covenant might be with Levi, says the Eternal of Hosts. So we are responsible to be worthy representatives, he's saying, that the covenant would guide and direct us. He shows how in verses 5 through 7, how we can be worthy representatives of God. Verse 5, my covenant was with him of life and peace. So we see that the covenant is with us, and I gave them to him for the fear wherewith he feared me. So we see really the first major point of what we do. He gave the covenant of life and peace. What in turn do we do? We are to have the fear to fear God and was afraid before my name. So true reverence. The representatives of God are men and women of devotion. Men and women of devotion. Secondly, the law of truth was in his mouth, and iniquity was not found in his lips. So they will be truth speaking. Truth speaking, men and women of honesty and integrity. The third quality that we are to have, he walked with me in peace and equity, and did turn away many from iniquity. So they are dedicated to obedience, men of action. Turn away many from iniquity, from sin. They are working to get sin out of the congregation of God. It starts with us individually, that we get sin out of our lives. The what now? The three starts with true reverence, devotion, in verse 5. Second one is truth speaking. The law of truth was in his mouth. Iniquity was not found in his lips. In other words, the law of truth versus the law of sin. And point number 3 is a dedication to obedience. He walked with me in peace and equity. Make sense? Rob? Verse 2, there were 3 points. I'm through with that. I'm on to another bunch of points. Okay, yeah, there he's just talking about these 3 aspects that they're supposed to do, to hear and to give heart to it and give glory. Now he's talking about the covenant. How do we relate as people of the covenant? I can see where we're getting confused. Maybe we could have made this then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 points. Anyway, I'm starting over then with these points, and I'll consider for the future making it 8 points. But he's talking about the covenant of life and peace. And if we're going to have the covenant of life and peace, then we continue with these points. Maybe that would be good, Russ. We could have them memorize all 8. It's 8 points instead of 3 and 5. Going on with verse 7. For the priest's lips shall seek knowledge, or shall keep knowledge, and they shall seek the law, the Torah, at his mouth. So they are teachers of God's law. Teachers of God's law. And whether you're male or female, whether you have an ecclesiastical responsibility to teach God's law or not, or whether it's to children or YES or YOU, it is a responsibility of teaching God's law. That's, yeah, or the five, whichever, however you're numbering it. I don't care how you number it. A teacher, so this would be point four, the way I was doing it, but point seven, the way John was doing it, and Rob. Okay, Rob, I'm going to blame this one on Rob then. I'm sorry. My apologies. Okay. But that's another point, whatever number you want to give it, okay? You don't have to memorize these by number or whatever. Teacher of God's law. Okay, for he is the messenger of the Eternal of Hosts. He is a messenger of God. And I'd make that point number five or point number eight, depending on where I started and if I ever were going to get done. Okay? Point number five, he is a messenger of God.